VCT Audio, the art of good listening.
You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
My name's Ian McMillan. I describe myself as a writer, broadcaster, performer, and a man about town.
Ian McMillan, a very warm welcome to A Mindful Life. We are here in the lovely village of Darfield in West Yorkshire, a place that you were born and grew up in. So what was life like for the young McMillan?
I'll tell you what, it was idyllic. I mean, the great thing about this part of Yorkshire is that it was part of the West Riding, and the West Riding of Yorkshire, up until 1974, was a wonderful educational experiment. The chief education officer was a man called Sir Alec Clegg, who said that all children are creative. So in my school down the hill at Low Valley, we sang songs, we did art, we made sculptures, and we wrote poems. And it was just a life full of writing, a life full of laughter. My dad was a Scottish Navy man. Him and my mum met as pen pals. He was from Scotland, she was from Yorkshire, she was from the next village, Great Oughton. We can hear people being shown around the museum where we're recording as we talk, just to show that it's actually real. So they met as pen pals. His auntie was a poet, and so poetry was always seen as important. Reading, poetry, writing, performance. So yeah, I am very, very lucky. I've always said I am the luckiest man because I had a fantastic childhood. I was at a school that encouraged creativity, the junior school. And so I always thought I could do this for a job. Never quite thinking how you could do it actually as a job. But that's what I've ended up doing. So yeah, life was great, I've got to tell you. Apart from, I had the worst hay fever. I had terrible hay fever, so I was always sneezing. And me and my mates would go out train spotting. We'd go out, I remember one time, we went train spotting down to the local pit, out in Maine. And all we could see was coal wagons going past, all you could see. And so we started fantasising. My mate says, I think I can see the Thames Clyde Express. I said, yes, you can. And my other mate went, there's the Devonian. So then we're taking it too far. We're going, I think that's Stevenson's rocket going past. And so that's what I remember. This life of like constant laughter and joy and making things up and sneezing because I had bad air fever. So you've got to imagine the poetry, the music, the art, punctuated by enormous pot-rattling sneezes.
No, it's a big... it was quite a small village, wasn't it, until they discovered coal, I suppose, and then it increased quite dramatically. Was there any pressure on you to go down the pit?
Well, my dad, he left the Navy in 1958, and he worked in an office in Sheffield. And there was always that thing, you don't want to go down the pit. But, of course, the pit was the huge employer. Mm. And so my... At secondary school, my careers advice was like the ones you get in Kes. He said, oh, you're bright, you can go to pit officers. You know, the idea that somehow the pit, the NCB, was like a cradle to grave thing that looked after you. That's why around here you get cricket clubs, you get choirs, you get brass bands. It looked after you. You know,
it was right to the heart of the community.
It was, it was right at the centre of the community. And, you know, after 84, 85, that all went. But I still get a sense that this feels like a community. You know, this museum where I volunteer at feels like part of that. But there was never any pressure to go down the pit. My mum and dad always said to me, you know, do what you want. Do what you want. My dad, because he was a Navy man, always thought I should get a proper job and, you know, perhaps be a writer in my spare time. He would encourage me to... He encouraged me to do my A-levels. He encouraged me to go to college. Nobody in the family had ever been to college. I went to North Staffordshire Polytechnic in Stafford, did a degree in politics and English, and they were very proud of that. They were really proud. But then I didn't want to get a career because I wanted to be a writer. Yes. So I went to work on a building site in Sheffield. Then I worked in a tennis ball factory in Barnsley. And then in 1983, God, a long time ago, the Yorkshire Arts Association were giving out these grants, and they give you up to £1,000 if you gave a job up, which is a lot of money now, and it's a lot of money then.
Yeah.
And I applied for this £1,000. We'd been married a few years, me and my wife. And I applied for this £1,000, and they gave me £800, which is like, it's not that much less, but psychologically it feels less, £800. But luckily, my parents and my wife have always been very, very encouraging. And they went, go on then, give your job up, have a go. And that's what I did. And that's why I, in my professional life, have always encouraged people. I've always said, you can do this, you can have a go. Because I'm so blessed and lucky that I've always been encouraged. What that means is that whenever I meet people, they say, I've got a poem for you. Yeah, do you like this poem? Have this poem. But I don't mind. But, you know, you get stopped on the street in Barnsley. I've got a poem. I was in the next village, Wombwell, recently, last week, doing some shopping. And this fella came up to me and said, you look just like that famous poet. I said, I am that famous poet. He says, what's your name? I says, I'm not that famous. He didn't know my name. He says, go and tell me. I said, I'm not telling you.
Well, it sounds like you've been certainly blessed with your upbringing and your education. You know, we could almost say how forward-thinking, but...
It was they were called trendy, child-centred education.
Yeah, you had a primary school that encouraged you to be a child. Mm-hmm. Too many children are growing up without being... without having that space to be a child.
And we didn't have the awful SATs, exams...
No.
All that kind of stuff. And it was different when I went to secondary school, because that was more traditional. But again, I had one teacher, Mr. Brown, Rob Brown, who was like a West Riding teacher, and said, you can be a poet. And again, encouraged me. So yeah, I had a blessed childhood, I must say.
So I suppose you've kind of answered the next question, partly at least, is your love of poetry, was it a slow burn, or was it a Damascus moment?
I think it was always there, you know. I think, like I said, my dad's auntie, Bella Howardson, was a Scottish Victorian rhyming balladeer, and she used to send him rhyming letters, you know, so that was...
Wow.
And here's Aunt Bella's letter, and he'd read it to me. She were dead, but he'd read it, you know, and you think, blimey, you know, if poetry comes to you through your DNA, that's where it comes from. Aunt Bella... My mum and dad met as pen pals. He was in the Navy, she was in the WAFs in the Second World War. So writing was important to them. My dad would sing all the time. He just never stopped singing. He didn't sing much, he didn't sing a wide variety of songs. He would sing Donald Wears Your Trousers, that was one of his favourites, and Sandy Shaw's Puppet on a String. He loved them two songs. But he sang all the time. So there's always been that link for me between song and poetry and kind of what you call human endeavour. So my dad would sing all the time. He died on Christmas Day 2001, and he'd had a stroke, and he wasn't very well. But I remember going to see him in hospital not long before he died, and he could hardly talk, but he was still singing, you know, anything. And that, so it's, for me, poetry just felt like a natural expression of speech, you know, that we could all do it. And it happens all the time in this museum. Folks are telling each other stories all the time. You know, it's like you get on the bus, you get on the train, people are telling each other tales. To me, that's poetry, and it's just...
And that's where the magic is, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's the job of the poet, in a way, to kind of say, well, this, you can do that. You can have a go at being a poet, definitely. So, yes. So it wasn't like a Damascus conversion. It was like, it just felt natural. It felt like this is what everybody does.
It sounds like your childhood, you were surrounded by poets.
I was surrounded by, you know, my Uncle Charlie. Couldn't read and write, but would tell these amazing stories. I used to play chess with him. But he thought it was called chest. Like, because round here, an odd dialect thing is they sometimes call the hearse, the funeral hearse, a hearst. Right. And he said, I play chest. And he thought that any piece could move in any direction, take any other piece, and be replaced by household objects. So this is true. You're playing chess, and he'd be just taking pieces all the time, and he'd get a boiled egg and swap it for king. Or he'd get, like, a packet of Park Drive and swap them. That was magical. My Uncle Jack... from Sheffield, what we call a Dida, because in Barnsley we talk like this. In Sheffield, because I love accents, in Sheffield it's much harder. Nadin, what dad doing there? What dad? So we call them Didas. Right. So when Barnsley plays Sheffield Wednesday, we all shout Dida, Dida at them. But my Uncle Jack, again, a storyteller, every on Boxing Day, you go to his house and he always had a joke ready. He'd have like a flower and squirt water at you, or he'd like an electric shake your hand. And one year he got a rubber jam tart. Right. And he went, Nadin, would I like a jam tart? And my dad, a very innocent man, despite the fact he'd been it well, my dad bit this tart and he went, hey, Jack, it's a bit rubbery. And Jack went, that's because it's a rubbering. And that was him explaining gag. And then for the next 10 years, we go to Uncle Jack's on Boxing Day and he get rubber jam tart again. And my dad would go, I hope he doesn't get the rubber jam tart. And me, Uncle Jack went, Nadin, did I want a tart? And so it was just that. He was just surrounded by... people just...
Sounds like Uncle Jack had a bad memory.
Uncle Jack, he was incredible. He was in the Second World War, like my dad, and he was at Western Desert, and he was sat exhausted on this sand dune, and the American General Mark Clark drove past in a Jeep, and my Uncle Jack went, "Nan in! And now that near Mark Clark." He says, "I am that soldier." He says, "Well, fighting's other way." So Uncle Jack got arrested. So just, and you're surrounded by that, we all are. And what I said to people is, people have said to me, they come to a writing workshop, they say, "I've done nothing. I've never done anything in my life." I said, "Well, tell us how you got here. Tell us what your mum did. Tell us what your dad did." And they tell you these. We've all got them. And what you have to say to people is, these are important. These stories are very important. You know, that's what... You say, yes, I was surrounded by poets all the time. Definitely.
Do you remember your first poem?
I do. I wrote it at school, and it was called My Budgie. And it went, "I have a little budgie in a cage of green. It is the cutest budgie that you have ever seen," that were in Mrs. Roach's class. And Mrs. Roach, she'd like give me a tick, a little sticker. And then I said to her afterwards, I said, "Mrs. Roach, I ain't actually got a budgie. I've got a canary." But I couldn't think of how to drown my canary. And she went, "Don't matter, Ian," because that was imagination. So that was it. And, you know, that was the West Riding thing. "Yeah, I have a little budgie in a cage of green. It is the cutest budgie you have ever seen." And that was when I was, you know, very, very young, infants. Yes. But what happened then is, I think it happens to a lot of us, when you get to secondary school, get to be a teenager, you think, "I don't want to write that rhyming tripe anymore. Rhyme is not for me. I don't want to." And I went through this odd period where I didn't write any rhyming poetry. And people have come to my writing workshops. I feel really ashamed of this now. When I was a young man, just starting off doing writing workshops, older people had come and they'd give me these rhyming poems. And I said, "Go away and come back and make it not rhyme." And now, as I'm getting older, I'm 67, I realise you can have both. You can have a poem that rhymes and a poem that doesn't rhyme. And I love rhyme. Ken Brooks, who you've met earlier, one of the volunteers here, he writes sonnets. He just looks writing sonnets. And rhyme tumbles out of him.
Yeah.
And years ago, I'd have said, "Ken, go away and make it not rhyme." But now...
That's interesting. We're going to talk about that later, about the different styles of poetry. So going back to Darfield, as you said, we're recording this podcast in a property, now a museum, in fact. It was donated to the village by one Maurice Dobson.
Maurice Dobson.
A fascinating man, born in a hard age, it's fair to be said. But he was different, wasn't he? And he learnt to defend himself with both words and fists.
Well, Maurice was that amazing thing. Him and his partner Fred were that very unusual thing in a pit village in the 50s, an out gay couple who were out and proud. Mm. And what a fantastic thing that is. And because they've both been in military, if anybody come in, if some pit men come in and said out to him, Maurice just gave him a crack.
Yeah, he was quite an accomplished boxer, wasn't he?
And they had a swearing parrot that used to swear at you. But Maurice would sit there in like a powder blue suit on a high stool with a cigarette in a holder, looking like Noel Coward.
Yes.
And he would. Oh, I love poetry. It was quite camp. It was quite camp. I love poetry. Yeah. And that story for me is a story of tolerance and a story of acceptance and a story of these two men can thrive in this village that, you know, people would say was, you know, old fashioned. But when he died, he gave the village, he gave the museum to Darfield Amenity Society gave the house as a museum. And that was kind of a bit of a shock to us, to them at the time, because what we're going to do with it? You know, and it spent ages getting it ready, and now it's a great place. My son is gay, and he's a poet, and, you know, he often looks to Maurice as an example. He didn't know Maurice, but the idea of this gay couple, who had this shop and were just accepted. The parrot, Mogaroff, he used to say, and there was all these fantastic stories about what happened to parrot. So one story was that Fred, the quieter of the couple, finally went mad and actually wrung the parrot's neck. Another story was that Fred and Maurice put it in back of a car, drove it off and released it up in Moors. Another story was, which I think is my favourite, they took it to Chester Zoo in a bag and left it on steps of Chester Zoo. But then a few years ago, we had an actor. We did a one-man show about Maurice, and as a kind of promenade show where people would come in and he'd greet them at the shop as Maurice and take them round. Yeah. And we asked some of the older people of Darfield, I said, "Did you enjoy that?" And they said, "Well, we're pretty good," he said. This fella said, "But Maurice weren't that tall." I said, "Well, he was an actor." But yes, it is. And I think you could dig anywhere and find these stories. That's what I like about this museum. You know, it's full of Darfield stories, but it's also, it's what I always call the universal in the local. You can find stories anywhere. And that's why, going back to what I said earlier, people say, I ain't done much, but, you know, my dad walked it here from Lincolnshire for work. You know, and you find universal stories of love, acceptance, struggle, anywhere that happened.
Now, Ian, you have a very distinctive voice, a beautiful, broad Yorkshire accent. How integral do you think is the voice to a poem?
I think there's two ideas of a voice. One is the physical voice, the voice that you have, which I've, as a young man, I spoke, my voice was a lot higher. Interesting, I can listen back to things I made. I've been doing this Radio 3 show for 21 years now, and I listen back to stuff I made only 21 years ago, and my voice is slightly higher. You know, and as a young man, oh, God, it was like that. Yeah. And as I get older, it's got deeper. Yeah. And I have to look after it, you know. I try not to eat any cheese or crisps and all like that, things that you love, but they clog up your clack, to use a technical term. And I think it is important. I think that, so there's that voice, there's the physical voice. Yeah. So when I write things, I always write them in my voice, knowing that often I'm going to have to say them aloud.
Yes.
So that works. People say, oh, it puts it on. People say, it puts it on, you know. I don't talk like that at house. I say, I do talk like this in the house. You know, they say, oh, at house he talks like King Charles. I say, no, in fact, the opposite is the case. In the house he talks like me. But there's that other thing with the voice, which is, what would you call it? The written voice, where you've got a style. I suppose that's what you call it, a style. Yeah. So you say, you've got the poet's voice. So, for example, my son, Andrew, he writes poems, his books have won awards. He's not like me. He doesn't sound like me.
Hmm.
And if I was metaphorically blindfolded and looked at two poems, one by him and one by me, despite the fact we're father and son, you could spot which were his, because he's got a poetic voice. He's got a voice on the page. So, yeah, voice is very important. And that's why I say to
so
people...
So I suppose they're intrinsically linked then, isn't it?
The it voice is. The voice on the page and the voice.
Creative side that produces a poem.
That's why in the end I always... People say, I've written this poem, I don't want to read it out to you because I'm not good at reading them. And you go, just read it. You know, it's your voice.
Who better to read it?
And sometimes actors do it.
Yeah.
And it's not as good. You know, because the actor will... They'll take more time. Yeah. They'll emphasise it in an actorish way. But you get somebody, you know, maybe they might stumble over the words. They might, and that's also a way of teaching them. If somebody reads a poem out that they've finished and they stumble over the words, you'll say, well, maybe it's not finished yet because those words maybe don't fit. You know what I mean? So yeah, the voice is very important. I do get people saying, you sound like that bloke, I'm telling you. I say, well, like I said, I did a voiceover for several series of a thing called The Dales and Lakes on Channel 4. And that was interesting, you know, because people would go, you sound just like him. And what I do sound just like is my brother, who also lives in Darfield, and he has a caravan up in North Yorkshire, and he'll be in a shop and go, bag of crisps, and they'll go, we enjoyed what you did on telly, because he sounds just like me. Oh, dear.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying, and I asked the question because... if I read one of your poems, I read it in the style that you would say it.
Well, that's right.
And I hear your voice when I'm reading it. If I read a poem that I don't know who they are, and I'm not, and, you know, then I read it in my
voice.
You read it
in your voice, yes.
So it's interesting what you say.
It is. It's an interesting thing that, you know, that once people know me, they'll read it in my voice. People, I tweet a lot, as you know. I'm always on Twitter, and people will say that they'll read my tweets in my voice. And, which is, that's kind of a compliment, if you like. It shows that maybe the voice is part of me. I'm interested to see what happens when I get older. You know, I'm 67, my voice is strong because I look after it. What will happen when I'm in my 80s?
Well, you know,
your voice starts
point.
To fade away.
If you were to lose your voice, would it affect your ability to write a poem?
I think it may well do, because you wouldn't be able to hear it. That's the interesting thing, you know, and that's why I try to protect my voice as much as I can, because I know it's my livelihood. You know, I've made a living in some ways through my voice.
Yes.
But my wife says, you mumble all the time. I said, I don't mumble. I don't mumble the blooming radio, madam. I don't mumble. Oh, dear.
Well, you know, I can think of some of the modern poets, John Cooper Clarke, Roger McGough, Pam Ayres even is probably a very obvious example of how their voice basically, I don't know, sells the poem.
It does. I mean, I love all three of them. I'm John Cooper Clarke. Because on Dead Ringers on Radio 4, they have this thing called Northern Poets, where they actually do impressions of me, Roger McGough, and John Cooper Clarke. And I do, the one they do of me, he doesn't sound anything like me. It's like, oh, they're all right. They're not, it's like Cod Yorkshire. And Roger, they make him sound like, you're right, dear lad. You know, like that. And they get John Cooper Clarke dead right because he's like that. But interestingly, perceptions of accents. Some people say to me, I like what you're doing on Poetry Please on Radio 4.
Yeah.
And I say, that's actually Roger McGough. It's not me. These are people from the South.
Yeah.
I mean, Radio 3 show, I've done it for 21 years. And one week they said to me, years ago, they said, Ian, if you were ill, we ought to get a stand-in. I said, good idea. So we're going to try somebody else out.
They tried your brother.
My brother, he'd have been better. Cause, well, they got a guy, Paul Farley, who was a really good poet and a good presenter, but he's a scouser.
Right.
So they had him on, and I said, oh, he sounded great. And then I said, how did it do? They said, oh, he sounded good, but he sounded just like you. I said, he didn't, you know. It's that thing where, but then on the other hand, I couldn't tell an Isle of Wight accent from a Berkhamsted accent. But yeah, no. I think Roger McGough is an example because of the way he talks like that, and his poems are all, ready, get it? And with John Cooper Clarke, it's all that thing, and it isn't. And Pam Ayres, I'm a huge fan of Pam Ayres, you know, I think, and people sometimes take the mickey out of Pam Ayres. You know?
I think when somebody becomes popular, they then underestimate the talent.
The craft. She puts such a lot of craft into her work. And I've interviewed her a few times. She's quite hard to interview because she'll say, oh, well, I'm not really a poet. Oh, well, I don't do much. But then when she can talk to her about the craft of it, because she does work hard on her poems, people assume they just come tumbling out, but they don't.
No.
These are great questions, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I'm enjoying this.
Thank you. I put a bit of thought into it.
Well, good.
Now, poetry comes in a variety of guises. We touched on it earlier, didn't we? From the sonnets of Shakespeare all the way to the, I suppose, the saucy seaside verses of the limerick.
Mm.
What is it about poetry, do you think, that stirs the soul?
I think it's heightened language. It's language that's turned up a couple of notches. It's language that is like we're talking now, but with a kind of tinge to it. So, for example, if I'm judging a poetry competition, I'll get lots of poems in from people who have been visiting relatives in hospital or they've been to a funeral, because at a moment like that of heightened emotion, that's why people like write love poems.
Yeah.
At moments like that, you reach for higher language. It's partly because a lot of us have been to church or chapel where you get that higher language. It's because a lot of us are fans of music where a love song, in whatever form it is, will be higher language. And you'll get that. And I'll get people giving me poems that actually don't actually make any sense, but will be in a kind of higher language. And they'll be trying to encapsulate feelings in language that is higher than the ones they would normally use. We're recording this the week before the coronation. And I know that people will write poems about the coronation because they'll be stirred to move in a certain way, to be moved and to move themselves. And there'll be a lot of rhyme, there'll be a lot of rhythm, there'll be a lot of... I still get poems with, like, words like doth and he do. There'll be words there that are there to make the poem sound like it's in a higher register. It's so interesting, so interesting. And what I'm a fan of is both ends of it. I like the higher language. I love it when people who've never written a poem before have a go at writing a poem. And it won't be perfect, but it's beautiful. And on the other hand, I like the very, very spare language of somebody like William Carlos Williams, American poet. One of his great poems is, "So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens." And oh, God, I love that poem so much because nothing much happens in it. It's just about a wheelbarrow. It's just natural language. But what he's done is, people say, well, my five-year-old could do that. He said they could. Actually, they could. And it's just basic, spare language. So I'm a fan of both ends. Both ends of the spectrum in language. I love heightened language, and I love the bare language of what people say. You know, you're walking down the street. I was walking down the street. People say things. This woman said, I was in this shop. I wrote a poem about it years ago. I was in this shop, and there was a range of novelty alarm clocks. And this woman went, shall I get a novelty alarm clock? And the bloke said, well, they're not even close friends. And I thought, wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, you can find, like I say, you find that magic in just everyday life.
That's what I like to do. And the only problem is then, you know, I'll go to a cafe with my wife and I'll be listening to somebody else. I'll be leaning in, you know, hanging the tab, as they say in Derbyshire.
Yeah.
You know, because you're always listening to folks saying things, which is the joy of language, the absolute and utter joy of language. It really is.
Now, the skill of a poet is to paint as picture as rich as any old master, really, with nothing more than words. Do you find your own style of poetry changing as you get older, and perhaps as you accumulate the experiences of life?
When I first started and kind of went freelance when I was a young man, I was doing two styles. My written down style was quite obscure, quite surreal.
Mm.
I still write that kind of poem, but that's what I did. And then, at the same time as I'm doing that, I'm standing up in folk clubs and reading the poems out, performing poems. And you found that the stuff on the page wasn't working so well because it was written for the page. It was written for you to take your time with.
Yes.
So I started writing more immediate things that would go down in front of an audience. And what I've always tried to do and always failed to do is find a kind of middle ground where you can write something that's sort of intellectually challenging for me and maybe for the audience, at the same time is accessible. I've always been interested in that. The kind of poems I like to read at home will be things that sometimes aren't very accessible and I've got to take my time with them.
Mm.
And the poems I like to read as well are the poems that are kind of instant, things like John Cooper Clarke or Roger McGough. I think one of the few poets that's ever got it completely right for me is Dylan Thomas. As a young man, as a teenager, I became obsessed with Dylan Thomas. And it's the wrong time of your life to become obsessed with him because you start writing poems that were like his, you know, which is no good. But his poems are quite hard to understand, but he would declaim them in a voice, quite a posh voice, actually. And he kind of mixed, in him, the poem for the page and the poem on the air met. So the older I'm getting, what I find myself doing, I'm writing fewer poems.
Yes.
I was talking to Simon Armitage, poet laureate, about it, and he said, when you're young, you've got a kind of poetic vigour, and that's the right word for it, where you're writing a poem, then you write another one, then you write another one, then you have a cup of tea and you write another one. You're full of vigour in terms of poems. As you get older, partly you start writing other things, so there's less time and space in your head to write the poems, but also you take your time more. So I'm writing fewer poems, partly because I'm writing other things. At the moment, my big writing job is translating The Barber of Seville, the wonderful opera, into Yorkshire dialect, which is one of them. Because years ago, I wrote an opera in Yorkshire dialect a few years ago for a composer called Alan Williams in Salford. Partly because we were both interested in dialect and opera, and can the operatic long note, can that hold the flat vowel that we're both talking from Yorkshire and Lancashire? And in the end, it can't, because opera singers are trained to sing in C pronunciation.
Mm.
So we had people. We tried it. We wrote this opera. It was really hard to get an opera singer to do it without taking the mickey, without kind of becoming cod Yorkshire or cod Lancashire. So then that did that. And then this other company said, would you like to translate The Barber of Seville into Yorkshire dialect? As you know, being freelance, you always go, yes, I'll do that. And then I wrote a bit and it went down all right. Then the pandemic happened. And then it happened for 2 years. And I thought, oh, it's gone.
Yes.
So me and my agent had our AGM recently at the start of this year. And I said to him, what about The Barber of Seville? He said, I think that's gone. That's gone. It's not going to happen. So we both went home. Then they rang him up that afternoon and said, Barber of Seville, we're going to do it. So
have you finished it yet?
Have you finished it yet? So the interesting thing about that is it's already been translated into kind of standard English.
Right.
So you've got no space to play with it. It's fantastic. No. So I can think of a load of gags that I could do and serious bits, but they've got to fit in. So you're like, hello, my man. You know, I've got that to play with. All right, and that kind of thing. So it's fascinating, utterly fascinating. So, and because of that, that squeezes out, I think, some of the poems. Because the older you get, maybe the more time you get, you need. Because going back to Simon Armitage's word, vigour is what you need. So I'm writing fewer poems. But then perhaps when I've written them, I'm more pleased with them, I suppose, because I've taken more time with them. And I'm not thinking, well, it don't matter if that one don't work because there'll be another one along in a minute.
Yeah. Well, talking about poems, it would be lovely for you to read either a poem of your own or somebody else. That's a favourite poem of
yours. One of somebody else's, if you like.
Absolutely.
This is by the great Pete Morgan. Now, Pete Morgan was one of the first people I ever met when I was wanting to be a poet. He was from Lancashire, from Lee. But he'd been in the army and he had quite a quite a posh voice.
Yes.
But the voice was the thing for him. The voice was the thing. I went on a week's writing course up in Heptonstall in West Yorkshire, and he was the tutor. And I was a teenager, and I was writing these poems. And he endlessly encouraged me and wrote these amazing poems that kind of combined...
Do you want me to... I'll hold your microphone if you like, that might get easier.
He wrote me these poems that combined rhyme and rhythm and a real poet's sensibility. So this is one from one of his... he died, sadly, a few years ago, and he was a great loss to poetry. So this, he signed this, look, Pete Morgan, Darfield, October 83.
Wow, that's going back a bit. You're at left school.
How old was I? I tell you what, that was when I was just starting to be a freelance poet,
right.
83. So I'd been on this course in 78 with him. And I did a thing that I always tell people not to do. I knew where he lived in York. I'd go to his house. Hello, Pete, I've got these poems.
I think that's an offence these days.
It is an offence, and it should be. Oh, hello, Ian. You know, but, and this is a poem about...
It's when he says, hello, Ian, again.
I know, hello again, Ian. Sorry, last week. So this got rhythm, rhyme, and it's called Hit. And it's about that thing when his lad... who's now a grown man, of course, has wound him up so much that he's getting a lad a clip right here.
I might relate to this.
Well, it's made him feel guilty, like you do.
Yeah.
So it's called Hit. And it's about the fact that his dad also gave him a clip, Pete's dad gave him a clip.
Yeah.
Hit. I raise my hand against my son and all night afterwards rerun a bitter sequence in my head. That hand is not this hand. Instead of this hand rising in the light, that hand is rough, the knuckles white, where skin is tight across the bone. This hand is not that hand. My own is long and delicate. The fists are skinny as a Lazarist's are bony. Not so quick, so square. That hand is not this hand, but where the fingers rise against the brain, I feel again that shock, that pain of snap rejection. Now I know this hand becomes that hand. I grow more like my father, on whose grave the ragged grasses misbehave. Gosh, I love those last two lines. I grow more like my father, on whose grave the ragged grasses misbehave.
It's beautiful.
And that's his dad turning in his grave, you know, and he's making the grass move. And that bit about the fists are skinny as a Lazarist's, I couldn't get that as first, but then I thought, well, it's Lazarus in the Bible who's risen from the dead and he's got skinny wrists. And so it's the idea of get his lad a clip, he's embarrassed and sorry about it, but at the same time he's thinking... This is me dad. This is me dad's hand. I think that's such a beautiful poem. Yeah. I would recommend Pete Morgan. He's forgotten now. So many poets are. You know, so many poets are lost and forgotten, and Pete Morgan's one of them. That's the thing. They're everywhere, these poets. But Pete Morgan, a fantastic poet, and you can tell by the way I read it that I love reading it. And that's what I'll do, you know, when I'm thinking about my poems, I'll sometimes get a book, maybe not by Pete Morgan, but by somebody, and I'll read it out just to maybe remind myself... I guess what a poem could be, you know, and then that'll spur me on to try something else. Because sometimes when people come to writing workshops, they go, I say, who do you read? They go, I don't read anybody. It might influence me. You go, yeah, but if your hobby was breeding budgies, you'd buy all breeding budgie magazines, you could, wouldn't you? You'd buy breeding budgie books. You'd go and talk about breeding budgies. And they go, but if I read somebody else's poems, they might influence me. You think, well, that might be a good idea. You know, the more you read, the better, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Pete Morgan.
Well, I was just thinking, I was watching you read that poem out now, and obviously you're an accomplished poet yourself, but I was thinking that Pete Morgan's obviously a hero of yours.
Oh, very much so.
And it's nice to see people that have made it and who are established still have heroes of their own.
Well, what excited me about Pete was he made a living as a poet.
Mm.
So he'd go into schools... So I went into a lot of schools. I don't go so many now. I call myself semi-retired, although my wife says, retire from what? That's a good point. So he went into schools. He did workshops. He wrote with musicians, which I do a lot of. And also, in a previous life, he was like a PR man. So every now and then, he'd write a bit of PR copy.
Right.
You know, so he did a lot of things, which
is
a freelance. You always have to do.
Yeah.
You do so many different things. And Pete was the kind of model for that, definitely.
Mm. Now, I know your son, Andrew, you've mentioned him previously, is an award-winning poet himself.
Mm.
So, and going back to influences, I suppose, do you think he's learnt a few things from his old dad, or or is the skill of poetry innate?
Well, I've got three kids, Andrew and my daughters, Kate and Elizabeth, and I always took them all to everything. They always went with me. My two girls were more into dancing. They both went dancing to the local dancing school. Andrew was always interested in performance. Mm. He was interested in, as a young man, he was in the local youth theatre. And I always said to people, join youth theatre, even if you don't want to be an actor, because it teaches you confidence. And as we know, confidence is the big thing. And then he started writing poems, and they were very different to mine. And I was so proud. I was so proud of him. And they're not much like mine at all. Then he started sending them off. And when he first started sending them off to magazines and publishers, he said, should I use a pseudonym? Mm. Because what you never want is people to go, oh, he's only got the gig because of his dad.
Yeah, yeah.
I said,
yeah.
Well, no, you know, do him anyway. And interestingly, because his poems are so different to mine, it often came as a shock to people
yes.
that he was my son. And I think somehow maybe poetry is innate. What it taught him was, because when he was at school, him and my daughters, they go, I bet you ain't got a telly. I bet you sit round all evening in a circle and read poems to each other. And then at the end, you don't clap, you snap your fingers like beatniks. And we go, no, no. And they go, is your dad, when I'm funny, when I do gigs and I'm funny, they go, yeah. Is your dad like that at home? He goes, of course he's not like that at home. Sits in an upset tea in a vest watching old Diagnosis Murder reruns. You know, it is, and what it taught him was that the poet can be he's an ordinary person. Mm. That's what it taught him. And the girls, you know, they taught him that, you know, it's a job. It's a job like any other. I regret, and they know this, that as a younger man, I was away quite a lot doing gigs, yes. you know, so you weren't around as much as you should have been. But no, he just saw it as an ordinary job. And when they did work experience, I took him for a fortnight with me. Yes. And it just to show, I remember doing an after-dinner speech for some doctors, that was part of it. I went down and did my radio show, all that kind of thing. And so he just saw that the poetry was a job. So when he left university, he'd had a couple of years of freelance, and now he's a professor at Manchester Met University, which is fantastic. Wow. Although my grandson, who's 18, says, so tell me again, Uncle Andrew, you're a professor. What do? Just sit about writing poems? He goes, yeah, I do. Because my grandson wants to be a doctor, which he sees as a more useful thing than being a poet. I can't argue with that.
A doctor of poetry,
doctor
perhaps.
Of poetry. See, I've got five. I am, in fact... Doctor Ian McMillan, because I've got five honorary degrees.
Right.
And it's terrible when you get an honorary degree because you haven't worked for it. And you have to walk up at the ceremony in front of the ones who've worked really hard for 4 years, and they're going, honorary degree to Ian McMillan, and you can see him going, he's not done a stroke.
Well, that's the old imposter syndrome, isn't
that's it? Exactly. I have that all the time, you know. I still think, even after all these
you still years, find yourself pinching yourself?
Not half. Thinking, am I going to do this? I'm going to get found out later on today. And people think it's a joke, but it's not, you know. You often think in a minute, you know, the poetry police are going to knock on the door and go, come with me, sir. Come on.
We've been after you for years.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. You silly old chump, you know. Yeah. There's that great line of Billy Bragg's, you know, the poetry police, tough on rhyme, tough on the causes of rhyme. You know, it's that kind of thing. You think they're going to get you. And it is true. And maybe that's a healthy thing. Maybe, you know... Maybe thinking, I've got to keep trying. Maybe that's good. I don't know.
Well, that very nicely brings us on to, finally, I suppose, they say in the practice of Tai Chi, students are taught to view the world and their surroundings as though seeing them for the first time, which is quite a difficult thing to do if you do it properly. I'm curious, therefore, how poetry influences your view of the world and how it helps with your own well-being.
Certainly, poetry has helped my mental health over the years. I think I have quite strong mental health, and I put that down to reading a lot of poetry, being accessible, being open to language and open to stories and open to seeing things new. That's the well-being and the wellness idea, the being in the moment. There is no after, there is no before, there is simply this moment. When I'm interviewing people on the radio, they'll go, as I said earlier, I said, I'd like to stop you there. There is no earlier. There is simply this moment when we're in the same space. So every morning, I get up ridiculously early. I've always woken up about 4:30. I don't know why. I don't really particularly want to. I wish I could stay in bed later. My wife says, stay in bed longer. I said, I can't. Because at 5:00, I feel so good.
Yeah.
I feel best. I'm going to feel all day.
Yeah.
And I go for my walk. I go for my early morning stroll, which does me good. I've lost a lot of weight in the last few years, and I put a lot of that down to walking and eating properly. But anyway, a lot of walking. So I go for my early morning stroll, and it's always the same stroll. I go down our street, down Snape Hill, back up Upper Wood Road, down Barnsley Road, back to our house. It's only 2.5 miles, it's not far, but it's a walk that I've walked all my life. And I try and see something different on the walk every day, and I tweet about it. And my task is every day to see something new in a place that I've seen the last 67 years. And that done half done me good, mentally and physically. And I think that's what, you know, on the other hand, people will say, well, I only write poems, people will tell me, you know, I'd like to write poems, but I can only do it when I'm miserable. I said, well, that's fair enough, you'll do that as well. And it might make you feel a bit better. But yeah, poetry, language, and feeling part of a poetry community has been really excellent, excellent for my mental health. I'd recommend it to anybody, I really would. And also walking and being a bit of a flaneur, you know, wandering about. I used to, my mum reminded me that when I was a young lad, I'd say to her, I'm going out in the garden to think. And I'd walk around the garden. And I still do that now. I find I can think better when I'm on the move.
Yes.
That does me mental health good. So, yes. And if ever I'm feeling down or a bit anxious, I will then go for a walk. So I go on my early morning stroll. If the papers haven't come to the paper shop, I do my shop stroll. I then do my afternoon stroll. And I do my evening stroll. And yesterday I did a little workshop at a place that's about 3 miles away. So I walked home. Because it just made me feel good, you know. Yeah. I would say a combination of walking. The Japanese haiku poets did that hundreds of years ago. They'd walk, they'd write a haiku, they'd walk to a river and float the poem down the river, and then kind of follow the poem down the river. So it's that kind of thing, just.
Yeah.
But I am generally blessed with good mental health. I think I'm an optimist, and that I think optimism helps. Being a Barnsley fan, you've got to be. Being a season ticket holder with the mighty Reds, you've got to be an optimist, you know. But you have to, and optimism, you know, pessimist. I don't like pessimists. Pessimists and cynics. Why? You know, if you're optimistic, I know you get disappointed a lot, you know.
Yeah.
You go, oh, we should have beaten that team, but we didn't. We should have, but you know, being an optimist, I think, is the best thing. I really do.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to say about walking, isn't it? And you go out to the garden to think. I think doing something like walking, it kind of takes you out of yourself, doesn't it? And if you're thinking about thinking,
yeah,
then that's when it all falls down.
And it's
I suppose.
Physical activity, so it makes your heart go, it makes your blood pound. I try and walk as fast as I can without running, because just to see if I can do it. And I walk really fast. I did try running, but I'm not built for running. But the walking really helps. My wife says you're becoming obsessed with your steps. I say, well, you know. I've no other vices, you know. I don't smoke, I don't drink.
I think that sounds like a brilliant title.
It's a good
of
thing.
A poem,
so I go, look, you're obsessed with your steps. I go, look, I've done 17,284. You're obsessed. Obsessed with your steps. But yes, I would recommend walking and poetry to anybody. A doctor speaks. A doctor, 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 doctor speaks.
Brilliant. Well, Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you.
I could sit here for hours and listen to you. So, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.